You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
Yes, good morning. It is Wednesday's OTB AM. Dave McIntyre in Jerry's seat this morning. Owen not around either, so I hope you won't be too disappointed. But we do have plenty to get through over the next hour and a half or so. And thankfully, from my point of view, and I'm sure everybody listening or watching out there on all of our usual social media channels and off the ball this morning, is Johnny Ward. Good morning.
Good morning. You're really bigging up the show there.
Thanks for coming in to hold my hand on this. I haven't done this in quite a while.
Yeah, it's a different shift getting up, but it's so early. It's mad the difference, so getting up for this shift now compared to a few months ago when it's dark. It's just so much easier, I think. Lovely mornings now, and just feels like you're kind of awake, whereas when you're waking up in the depths of winter, it's hard.
Life in general is so much easier when you're waking up and the birds are singing, the sun is shining. And
yeah, the rugby game on Sunday, I know I'm kind of very worried about global warming, and I think it was unnaturally hot, but loads of the Toulouse fans like were covering their heads to keep the sun out, and you know, these French people in Dublin in April, it was so warm and beautiful, everyone just buzzing, you know. And
I was pitch side at about 11:30 on Sunday morning, and it was boiling pitch side. I could only imagine what it had got to by the time the game kicked off. But
yeah.
You know, while you enjoy every minute of the sunshine, there is also a certain amount of guilt knowing that it's early April. It was very much this way in January and February as well. I remember playing golf one day in a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Yes, it's brilliant and everything, but it's not really supposed to be like this.
No.
And we're probably going to pay for it further down the line.
Yeah, definitely going to pay for it. I do every time now. There is a nice day in Ireland that's not consistent with what the weather should be. There's a qualified enjoyment of it. You know, I remember the news, the RT news in February were saying, like, you know, they had a kind of a very light, kind of fluffy story about how people were eating ice creams and, you know, basking in the weather. It's like, it's 12, 14 degrees here in February. This is not normal, you know.
No.
I think global warming in Ireland, even the last 10 years, has been really evident how ridiculous the weather has changed in Ireland alone.
This could turn into an environmental show very quickly, but unfortunately it's something I'm spending far more of my days thinking about. Let's not talk about it. Let's just focus on the sport for the next hour and a half or next couple of hours. Do get in touch with us this morning on Twitter. Drop your text in and get in touch with us on all of our usual social media channels. We are going to talk about several different things over the next couple of hours or so. But the fact that you're here this morning at all, Johnny, is great because you were out on the beat last night. Were you there as a fan at the Tallaght Stadium watching a really intense battle between Bowes and Shamrock Rovers?
Yeah.
Bowes keeping this title race very much alive and bringing a halt to Rovers' gallop at the moment.
Yeah, I was there as a fan. I did a small bit of work there, did a little piece with David McWilliams, who I met actually on Off the Ball when we did the paper review there, maybe last year sometime. And I'd never met him before, but I put it up to him to come to a League of Ireland game just to try it out. So
he'd never been?
He'd been to Rovers games back in Milltown in the day, so
so we're talking about 1980s.
Yeah, familiar enough story, an old Rovers fan who sort of, obviously Rovers then became nomadic and all that, but so that was a little bit of work I did, a little bit of an interview with him, and he came back and he brought his son and his son's two mates to the game in a crowd of around 6,500, so that was my little bit of work. But got home at around 11 o'clock. It was a disaster trying to get out of the car park. I don't think the traffic kind of coordinators are used to crowds like that in Tallaght, because it was 25 minutes just stuck in the car park, nobody moving. But that wouldn't take the gloss off what was a great occasion.
A lot of who's who there as well. A certain Nathan Murphy was there as well, I believe.
Nathan Murphy. And
he's introducing his young fellas to the League of Ireland.
The two eldest, yeah. You know, one of them, I think, was wearing a Mo Salah top, but, you know, we'll forgive them that. Nathan really enjoyed it, and the two kids were there. I was just commenting on that last night on Twitter. And Dave McWilliams was making the point about how many mixed race kids he saw at the game. And there's obviously Mick McCarthy and Robbie Keane, and enjoyed the game as well. That was just a tweet I put up. And on the pitch, Danny Mandrea.
Read the tweet just for our radio listeners. Modern Ireland very much evidenced tonight with mixed race footballers pivotal on the pitch and loads of mixed race kids in the crowd. Lots to be proud of in Irish football. So there was a real diversity on and off the pitch last night, which is great to see.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if you look at all the League of Ireland teams from under 13 up to under 19, under 8, so under 13, 15, 17 and 19, every club, and that's 20 teams, they all have mixed race kids, and it's just a sign of modern Ireland, be they in sort of Longford or Dublin. And it's fascinating to see, but you look at the influence these players are having. Danny Mandreou, I think he's Irish Romanian, like he's a Dublin lad, but I think his dad is Romanian. He was absolutely outstanding last night and had a technical prowess that, dare I say, it was more what we would expect of somebody from sort of Romania than Dublin, because we don't really look on ourselves as technical footballers, but the likes of him are changing that, how we view ourselves. And if you look at some of the football played last night, I think the League of Ireland is in a great place, you know, despite the shambles the FAI has been, and trying to explain to Dave McWilliams that this is a league that basically functions despite there being no prize money and no TV money, and the fact that the FAI and the clubs have entered into an agreement where nobody really knows how much SSE or Tristy are even putting into the League of Ireland. Do you know? So it's marvellous the progress that has been made. A lot of issues in the game still, but last night was so enjoyable. 6,500 people there. You know, a great buzz on social media about it, and I think Mick McCarthy and Robbie Keane would have enjoyed the first half anyway very much.
So on the pitch, Bowes won it with a penalty, a disputed penalty. They are now five behind Rovers, who have played one more game than Bowes as well. It obviously opens things up for Dundalk, who have to play Rovers in the next few days also. So we're probably going to have a decent title race. Let's hear from the Bowes goal scorer, Dinny Corcoran, last night. He spoke after the game to our very own Jamie Moore.
Just with Bohemians goal scorer tonight, Dinny Corcoran. Dinny, the fans are still going crazy behind you with your manager. Have you ever experienced a derby like this in your life?
No, I don't think so. I think this one was a bit extra special due to the league positions. I think we needed to close the gap on them. We couldn't let them get too far ahead, but they're still top of the league. We've a big match on Friday now. We can't enjoy it too much. We have to get the heads down and recover now for Friday.
What did you make of the first 38 minutes with the two reds and your penalty save, and you managed to scramble in the rebound?
Yeah, it's a bit crazy. The matches are usually kind of hectic enough. They're not really not much football played, but it's two sending offs. I thought Danny was throwing goal. I'm not sure. I'd have to see them again, to be honest. And the second yellow for Lee Grace, I don't know whether it hit him in the face or the hand. I don't know now. So I'm not going to comment on them saying they were red cards, but obviously they changed the game and with the numerical advantage. And we done well, that we kept the ball well, made the move, and they didn't really look like great until much other than set pieces. So yeah, happy with the performance.
Talk us through the penalty. You missed it, but he just dropped the rebound right in front of you.
Yeah, I was lucky enough because we got a penalty against him start of the season and I put it that play, so I kind of knew, I had a feeling he got it right away, but luckily it spilled to me and I just had to tap it in, so delighted.
That's Dinny Corcoran, who got the winner against Rovers last night at the Tallaght Stadium. Briefly on this, are Bowes the real deal? Can they stay the course and really keep Rovers on their toes, or have Rovers shown too much quality over the last 12 weeks or so to suggest that the likes of Bowes are in a place to really go after them at this stage?
I suppose it's a bit like Wikipedia, when, you know, there's a story on Wikipedia about a story that's developing, and, you know, it's kind of pointed out to you at the top, this is a developing story and, you know, this is going to change rapidly. Well, Bowes are a bit like that, because this is happening really fast. This is a team that shouldn't be anywhere near where it is, in the sense that many people would have predicted they might even struggle to stay in the division this season because of the changes they made. They lost their keeper, Shane Supple, who would have been the best keeper in the league. They lost their two centre-backs. They lost other players as well, and they've conceded, I don't think they've conceded a goal from open play. Conor Levinson, Danny Grant and Mandreou last night. I mean, Levinson and Mandreou in stages. And Mandreou is a bit of a blank canvas because he's played very little professional football. He scored an unbelievable goal at Belfield earlier in the season. And now all of a sudden people are looking at Bowes and saying, hang on a sec, are they actually title candidates? Because when you said at the start of the show, the gap to Dundalk, that's what's in my head, the Rovers-Dundalk gap. I've said all season, I think it's a two-horse race, but you're looking at, I saw Bowes against UCD on Friday, and UCD played them off the pitch for much of the first half, and you're like, well, I really expected Rovers to win the game last night, but Bowes at 11v11 I thought they were every bit as good as Rovers last night, and with the amount of young players they have, why aren't they title contenders? Why not? I think maybe as the season goes on, injuries to the likes of Dinny Corcoran might make them struggle. But at the moment, they're not conceding goals anyway. And Keith Long and Trevor Crawley, now they're always put together as a double act, even though Keith Long is the manager and Crawley is the coach. What they've done with that team is just astounding. And I was at the Bohemians game the other night against UCD, who wouldn't traditionally bring any support to games. The atmosphere at Daly Mount was just so warm. It really made you want to be there. And that club, whatever it has done, despite the fact that there isn't money, and in fact, it's probably somewhat because there isn't money, it's almost like an anti Premier League or an anti kind of real professional sort of attitude, maybe anti modern football, in that it's real community based. They do a lot of work with the community. Mm. And it just so happens that they have a brilliant managerial team that has put this little team together out of nowhere that are all of a sudden possibly title contenders. Fantastic experience in Finsbury every time you go there, and they're going to sell out again on Friday night against Waterford.
Yeah, Bows have done an awful lot of work away from the headlines of the first team over the last 12 to 18 months off the field and in the community, as you say, and it looks like it's reaping dividends for them now. Going to give you an opportunity now to get involved in this morning's competition every day this week to celebrate the launch of the new Liverpool 2019-2020 home shirt, which is dedicated to Bob Paisley. There it is there. We've got a jersey to give away every day on hashtag OTBA. The new kit will be available for pre-order in store at the official LFC store in the Ilex Centre in Dublin, and it will be online from 9 a.m. on the 18th of April. So what's that? This what day is today? 24th. So last week you had a week to get your hands on it already. So it's guaranteed for worldwide delivery on the launch day, which is the 9th of May, when it will also be available to purchase in store and online. Going to give you a look at it here. John, have you seen this yet? It's very impressive for those of us who are old enough to remember what Liverpool shirts of the 80s and 70s. What do you think?
It's a lovely jersey, yeah. I was actually commenting on this earlier to myself. It does disappoint me how it's just acceptable that you change your jersey every season now, because I don't think you really need to. I think jerseys don't have a chance to establish any sort of memory bank with fans, because they just change so often, and I think older fans just don't buy them as much anymore. But that is actually a lovely jersey.
Yeah, there was a time when you could, in your mind's eye, picture every Liverpool or United or Arsenal shirt going back over the last 15 or 20 years, because you got at least 2 years out of every home shirt. Look, we know why it's been changed every season. It's not because the football clubs are desperate to show the football supporters how great they are in arts and crafts and design and how creative they are from that point of view. It's so they can put some pressure on parents to buy the new jersey every year.
But they're losing meaning, the jerseys, now, because they change so often. I think if
an aspect of the game of modern football losing meaning.
Yeah, but this is, I mean, the League of Ireland is great and all that, but it's the same, the League of Ireland. Every club seems to have a new shirt now each year, and maybe I stand correct on that, but I don't see why there's any need whatsoever. Why can't you just establish a nice jersey? You have a contract with whoever the sponsor is, you have a contract with Adidas or New Balance or whoever, Kappa, Umbro, and you say, listen, yeah, we're going to have this jersey for 2 or 3 years.
Well, you know the answer why. Because you earn more money by changing it every year.
Yeah, I'm not sure though. Maybe down the probably you always will make more money. But like if even as a Galway United fan, I wouldn't buy the jersey every year. I just don't see the point in why you have.
If you had a couple of kids who are huge Galway United fans, they might want the new jersey every year. That's where the pressure comes.
That'll be an argument for when I have kids, I suppose.
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
Be a nice argument to have.
This is what's coming up on this morning's OTB AM. We are going to get stuck into the sports pages in just a couple of minutes' time. Gary Breen is going to join us to talk Manchester Derby and the implications for the title race, where Manchester United are at the moment. Some interesting comments from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer yesterday. So that's around about 10 minutes' time, 10 past 8. Once we get through the Manchester Derby, so if we're going to get the sports news, bring you through everything else that's happening in the world of sport. What a time for Irish football. We've just been talking about the atmosphere at the Tallaght Stadium last night. Shane Long got his third in four games last night. The Irish goal scorers have been peppering the sports pages over the last 48 hours. So maybe all is not as bleak as we thought it might have been when Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane left the position with new management team and everything. So we'll touch on that a little as well. Very interesting story coming from Galway GAA. It involves the Naiff Columbkill club, who have
Donegal
been banned
GAA.
From playing. Yeah. What
you
did
said,
I say?
You said Galway. I just have to defend.
Did I? Right. Donegal GAA. Yeah. They've been banned for 8 weeks from playing any adult club games, and they've been fined €500 on the back of a charity event that did involve a little bit of soccer that was played to raise some funds for a local man who was diagnosed with motor neuron disease at the back end of 2018. There's been a lot of social media fallout from that, but we'll get a little more detail as much as we can around about 10 to 9. We're going to touch on Saracens, and there's been some Leinster chat, obviously, with one eye in St James's Park on the 11th of May and the Heineken Champions Cup final. But let's get a view on how things are being viewed over in Allianz Park. Saracens will be speaking to... who is it? We're going to be speaking to Charlie Morgan from The Telegraph. That's after 9 o'clock, and just get their view on things. We're still 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks out from that huge game, which has been described as a game with a Game of Thrones feel to it by Gordon Darcy at this morning's Irish Time. And what did Johnny Sexton say after the game? This will be the biggest battle of all of our careers. So they've set it up nicely with some nicely strongly worded statements on the game. And then we're going to speak to John Duggan about Tottenham, the big win last night, big game from the in the Premier League last night as they saw off Brighton. Tommy's just told me that we never actually gave the competition questions. So if you want to win this morning's jersey, just tell us which Liverpool manager brought Fernando Torres to the club. You know that one off the top of your head? Mm. I think I know the answer, but I could be wrong. So which Liverpool manager brought Fernando Torres to the club? Get in touch with us this morning. And Tommy, how do you want to get in touch? Twitter? Yeah, tweet us, give us your answer, and you'll have a chance to win that lovely jersey. Leave a comment as well. So that's for the Liverpool football shirt, the new one for next season, which we are giving one of which away every day this week. OK, time for the sports pages. Right, I'm going to start with the Irish Times here. It's no surprise, all focusing on the Manchester Derby tonight. The excoriation of United's players ensures a big Derby Day response. And a related story comes on the back of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's comments 24 hours ago about the Manchester City players will be biting at your heels, biting at your ankles. Guardiola says Solskjaer is trying to influence the referee. City manager angered by the suggestion that his players repeatedly commit fouls. I mean, there's absolutely nothing in this, really. But it's the usual nonsense. You get a little bit of a build-up to a derby game.
Yeah.
It's going to be an interesting one tonight. I think a lot of Manchester United fans are just going to find a rock to crawl under. And I pretend this whole thing isn't happening, because there are some United fans that would see a United victory tonight or a draw as not necessarily being a great thing. If they produce a response to that debacle that was Goodison Park on Sunday afternoon, put it up to City, show a bit more about themselves, get a point or 3 points, you've essentially handed the title to Liverpool. Isn't that would that be the case in your view?
Yeah, but do they not want to finish fourth, you know?
I would think the United's chances of finishing fourth at the moment, while the table implies that there is still a considerable possibility of them finishing top four, that late Eriksen strike last night, I don't think United are catching Tottenham. And they have Chelsea this weekend. They could finish above Chelsea even with a defeat tonight. I just think it's unlikely.
It's unlikely.
The one in that Arsenal have as well.
Like, really, they should be more worried about finishing top four than Liverpool winning the league. Now, maybe it doesn't work like that, but to finish in the Champions League is... When Solskjaer came in, did the Champions League, the FA Cup, and finishing top four, and it's likely they're going to fail on all fronts there, and they should be looking to finish top four. And with how badly their three rivals performed at the weekend in terms of the top four race, there is still hope. Chelsea don't really look convincing. Clearly, Arsenal are far from convincing at the moment. Spurs should be okay, but I don't know. I've no faith whatsoever in them getting a result tonight. I think Liverpool have been desperately unlucky in the way the cards have been dealt at the end, in the sense that Spurs beating Man City in the Champions League just wasn't ideal for them, trying to beat them again on Saturday. And Man United are just a shit show at the moment. You know, they're losing form at completely the wrong time for Liverpool, because Man City did have notionally a tough title race, a tough title kind of last few games, but this doesn't look tough at the moment.
No. What have you got there?
Yeah, this is United way off the pace, Ole. This is the Herald, which is obviously self-explanatory. Cronin up against the clock in terms of getting back for the final against Saracens. Obviously suffered an injury in a fairly bruising encounter. And Airtricity League, Dinny's Derby Delight. It's good to see the Herald with a bit of bows on the back page. So plenty there. And obviously tributes to the Lisbon line as well. Billy McNeil. Lovely gesture from Shamrock Rovers last night, where they played, I forget the song that glorifies the Celtic 1967 team, but they played that in tribute to Billy McNeil before the game. And their use of music before the game for a crowd that was building up, unusual for a League of Ireland game, was excellent. And I thought that was a lovely touch to honour Billy McNeil.
Yeah, there are one or two other stadia which shall remain nameless, that might learn a lesson or two from that in terms of trying to build a fake atmosphere, maybe complement the atmosphere that's already building, as you've described it there. The Irish Daily Mail this morning, GAA under fire, and we've just referenced it briefly. Furious club is banned over charity match. Donegal All-Ireland winning defender Eamon McGee has condemned GAA authorities for handing out an 8-week ban to a local club for hosting a charity fundraiser. We're going to get stuck into that story in a little more detail with Chris McNulty later in the show, but it's an interesting one. The temptation in these situations is to lunge 2 foot in at the GAA without maybe getting our hands on the facts and the detail first. So before any of us do that and accuse them of getting themselves involved in another unmitigated PR disaster, I think it's probably fair on everybody just to go through the detail a bit more before we do that. Munster need Zeebo back, says O'Gara. Ron O'Gara was on Off the Ball yesterday saying that he would like to see Simon Zeebo return to the club and that there are some burnt bridges to be mended. I hope I'm not misquoting Rog on that one, but I don't know, there's more to that as well. I don't think it was a case that Simon Zeebo fell out with Munster. I think it was a case that he wanted a new experience, probably didn't see his future with the Ireland team in as much of a degree as other Irish internationals over the last few years, and it's not like he's not having a spectacular season. He can't stop scoring tries, and Racing have had a really good European season getting to the quarters, and they're very much in a position to go deep into the playoffs and the top 14 as well. What's next for yourself?
Yeah, we have the Sun here. It's all kicking off. United boss Warren Starr's flop again, and you'll get the boot. I think that's the interesting narrative that Liverpool can kind of cling to in terms of Manchester United tonight, that the players are under pressure. Angry Guardiola hits back as Ole's tactical foul jibe. Just on that, I read an article yesterday in the Times. And basically, I think the point of the article was there's literally, I think, one player in Man United would be sad to see kind of go at the end of the season, and the rest would be like, nah.
That being David De Gea.
Rashford,
yeah. Right. And yeah, I think De Gea's form hasn't even been great.
I think with De Gea, maybe the expected, but that's the only thing I think Liverpool have in their favour tonight is that these players are sort of playing for their future, some of them. Now, I think Solskjaer will have already decided that some of these lads are gone, definitely. Mm. If Pogba is in that or not is probably the main question, but that's the only thing they're going, because they shame themselves against Everton and they have to produce a reaction. I'm just not sure the reaction will be anywhere near good enough.
Well, you have to think if they get a fee of about 80 or 90 million for Paul Pogba and he wants to go, I'm not sure anyone at Manchester United would stand in his way. Because
surely get that, would they not, at the very least?
You would imagine. If it's Real, for example, that are coming calling, can probably get them to pay top dollar. At the back of the Racing Post, as big as it gets, City can take huge step towards title with victory at Old Trafford. We'll talk about this with Gary Breen in a few minutes, but you know, you could make an argument that it's tonight is the title.
Yeah.
City win tonight, they're going to win the league. City don't win tonight, Liverpool are going to win the league. I expect the two teams are of such high quality. Liverpool have really found their feet again. They're playing very good football. All of their games over the last month, they've had to dig it out.
Yeah,
they've shown real title title-winning ability over the last month. I think they'll win out, and I think City win out.
Yeah, it's been a hugely successful season for Liverpool regardless. You can't control stuff like how many points Man City get, apart from the two games you play against them. If they finish on 97 points, I think it's way better than Man United's ever... best ever tally when they won the league.
It'll be more points than Liverpool have ever won in our lifetime.
Yeah, and it's...
The prospect of them not winning the league is quite ridiculous. Fire on through the rest of them there and we'll get stuck into all that.
It's a successful season anyway. You know, and the nasty neighbours, Mirror Sports, Ole, they will snap at your ankles and kick you. The ref must watch it. Did he say that, Pep? I've never sent a player out to foul anyone. Z. And then on to the Times with Shane Long on the back. Cronin and Ruddock may miss cup final in relation to Leinster. Obviously, the Shane Long story is something that we shouldn't underestimate as well. With McGoldrick being brilliant for Sheffield United the other day, Long is a reminder that he hasn't gone away, and FIFA has declined to comment about the prospect of appointing a normalisation committee to steer Irish football out of troubled waters. From John Fallon, that's actually a very interesting story as well, where they're going in that regard. And yeah, that was the Mirror before that.
Okay, this is the Daily Telegraph. Guardiola cries foul over Solskjaer claims, so more of the same nonsense really ahead of this game tonight. And Eriksen to the rescue. Brilliant strike from Christian Eriksen last night against Brighton. Late winner keeps Spurs on course for a top four finish, because again, another thing that maybe Arsenal fans, Chelsea fans, Manchester United fans would have been wary of over the last few weeks, given that Tottenham's league form started to totter a little. They got to a Champions League semi-final, there was the possibility Tottenham were going to finish fifth. Mm. And due to either a Chelsea, Arsenal or United, what Chelsea did to Tottenham in 2012 when Tottenham finished fourth and ended up not playing in the Champions League the following season. So that possibility has receded significantly after that victory over Brighton last night.
Absolutely. Brighton still kind of just holding on in there. Obviously the Indo as well. I've got to give the use of work for the Indo. And I know the work they would have done. John Moore has just left the Indo offices now. It was funny because I thought his print was all over this, getting that crucial photo of the league race, was it or not, a handball, back page, last knock-ins before the paper goes to print. Guardiola hits back at claims of strategic City fouling, and Rovers again hit by Gypsy Curse.
Yeah, and finally for the papers here at the back of the Guardian, Guardiola hits back over Solskjaer and the foul claims. Let's not go into that anymore. And then Eriksen rocks Brighton. Houghton's men punished by Spurs while Long creates Premier League history with 7-second goal. There is a mention on two of the big stories. One was covered on Off the Ball with Joe and Ken Doherty last night. Amateur hour, snooker shock as outsider Cahill. I assume it's, is it Cahill? Cahill? He's an amateur as well. He came through the qualifiers last week. It's quite brilliant. Held his nerve to beat Ronnie O'Sullivan, the world number one and the five-time world champion. 10 frames to 8. And Billy McNeil, farewell to a Celtic legend who roared with the Lisbon Lions. The snooker one is interesting. It's a spectacular opening round. There's the Irish news as well for our viewers on offtheball.com. It was an honour to play for Billy McNeil, says Rogan. I mean, he is a legend of the club. The Lisbon Lions, there are not as many of them around now as there would have been. It's a big story every time one of them passes away because they achieve so much. And all that story about them all being born within 3 miles of Parkhead and what they had to overcome to go and win that championship and being the first British club to win the old European Cup.
Proper football days when the club really was, you know, represented by local players and that.
There was a connection between the players and the locals. Yes, they were probably earning above the average industrial wage, but it wasn't stratospheric like it is now. And I mean, what the ordinary Joe earns bears absolutely no relation to what the likes of the Premier League stars are earning at the moment.
That's again, I think, why this Bowes team is so popular. They're basically on an average wage, if even. They're kind of part-time. Keith Ward, I've seen him in town kicking beer barrels into the cellar. That's his day job, you know, and then he comes on and plays outrageously well second half last night at times. And they're local Dublin lads, and they come from different backgrounds, but they're Dubs. They're basically, Keith Buckley cycles home from games at times, takes selfies himself cycling home from games, and Talab with all the Bowes fans behind him and the Lewis. It's a lovely story, and it's kind of anomalous in football nowadays.
Yeah, something very romantic about that. That is it for the sports page this morning. Just want to touch on a couple of those stories. I want to talk about the rugby injuries in a sec, but the Ronnie O'Sullivan one, it's a huge story, and it's a spectacular way to kick off the week or the 2 week spell at the Crucible, but at the same time, you've lost Ronnie O'Sullivan.
I know, yeah. I was reading, the Times had a great piece with Jimmy White yesterday, and Jimmy White was going on about, you know, playing Alex Higgins, and Alex Higgins, how much drink he'd have on him, and really old style snooker days. But he basically said down the piece, you know, I fancy Ronnie to do it this year. And while I was reading this, he was actually losing out to an amateur, and the stars have definitely aligned now for some of the other players on the other side of the draw as well, or on that side of the draw rather, because it's in terms of trying to promote the game, it was a great story, but you want Ronnie there. Obviously, you definitely want Ronnie there. But it's a fascinating tournament this year.
Yeah, for the casual snooker fan, they probably wouldn't have tuned in maybe until week two. And you want to see Ronnie there. Now, I don't watch the snooker anywhere near as much as I used to, but I used to absolutely love Ronnie. I loved watching Jimmy White. I loved watching Alex Higgins. There aren't as many of those. It's the old cliche I'll throw out. There aren't as many of those characters in the game anymore. But I really wanted to see him, you know, join Steve Davis in six and get himself a year closer to maybe joining Stephen Hendry on seven. It's hard to believe that Ronnie O'Sullivan is the best ranked, highest ranked snooker player in the world. 26 years? Did he win the UK Championship in 93? 26 years later, and he's still the world number one. Despite playing only a handful of tournaments every year, in order to keep his ranking as high as it is, he pretty much has to get to the quarterfinals, semis and final of every tournament he enters.
Yeah, I guess the void incredible created by his departure is partly filled by his conqueror, who now has become the romantic story of the tournament. You know.
Yeah, well, let's see how far James can go, because he showed real ice cool demeanour as he won those last couple of frames. And Ronnie O'Sullivan afterwards talking about how he could barely keep his eyes open, he was nearly falling asleep in his chair. You mentioned Sean Cronin there in one of the backstories. That could be a massive blow to Leinster, because he's touch and go now for that Champions Cup final in Newcastle on the 11th of May, If he's not there, obviously James Tracy came off the bench and did a really good job against Toulouse at the weekend, but you are losing depth. They've already lost Levy, they've already lost Josh van der Fleer. You just fear for Leinster because they have a couple of really big Pro 14 ties playing Ulster at the weekend. They just need to ensure that they don't lose any more main key men before they get to this final, because Saracens, as Johnny Sexton said, it's going to be the battle of their careers.
Yeah, like I'm obviously kind of only half up on this, but the I guess the thing is Saracens, the physical nature they're going to bring to the game as well, and it's going to ask an awful lot of Leinster. They've come through two very tough games, you know, the Ulster game. I really thought they kind of wobbled through that. The Toulouse game is an awful lot closer than the scoreline suggests. You know, that interception towards the end. Toulouse brought a big game to the Aviva Stadium, and you can tell there's a lot of war wounds out there, but. Leinster have a great mental fortitude, I think. They get over the line, and that game's going to be a rugby game like that in St James's Park. I think that's going to be a great experience.
Yeah, they know how to win. You mentioned the Ulster game there. The man who got the try that clinched that game as well, Adam Byrne, he's missing for the rest of the season as well. So they can't really afford to lose anymore, and they've still got a couple of massive games to go before they start turning their attention to what's going to be happening in that game against Saracens. In a couple of weeks' time. Okay, Gary Breen is with us next on OTBAM. We are going to be chatting Manchester United hosting Manchester City in the derby at Old Trafford tonight. Last night, was it last night, Tommy? Pat Nevin chatting on Manchester United and what he's seen of them over the last couple of weeks.
You talked about that team there. You go through some of them. Martial, love him as a footballer. Worked great. Not so sure now, but he's a great footballer. Lukaku, well, we know.
Yeah,
You're not going to get that every week. For no chance. And it's never been the case all the time I've been watching him. So I ain't going to change that. Lepa's not going to change his spots. Pogba, there's been games this season where I've watched him. Was it the Wolves game when they get beat with Wolves? Honestly, he was bullied all over the place by Wolves. And he shouldn't be doing that because he's a world-class player. Matic just looks as if, you know, it's just been a season too far for him. And then you go to the back line, and the back line, you know, they're a decent back line. But they're not a top six type back line. They're not that good. I don't think any of them are really good enough. And there's an interesting point. We think, how many of those back four, you know, would you take if you were Spurs? Were you Manchester City? Were you Liverpool? Were you Chelsea? Would you really look at them? Even Arsenal? Would you look at any of them?
No.
And I don't think you would. And that's a massive story that the club's let itself get into that situation. So not good enough in certain areas for where they want to be. But also, you can get over some of it with spirit. They showed a bit of it for a while, but they've now shown that they cannot keep that up. And that's a horrendous situation they now find themselves in, because that's not your manager's problem. That's something much.
Yeah, that was Pat Nevin speaking to Joe last night on the demise of Manchester United and really in the overall personnel. Gary Breen is joining us on OTBAM this morning. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, guys. I'm very well, thanks.
Pat Nevin, I'm going to paraphrase him there and maybe put words in his mouth, but in some ways he was giving Ole Gunnar Solskjaer a little bit of a pass on what's transpired over the last few weeks when they've lost 6-8 and the wheels have really come off. The impact that he had made initially with that incredible run of games where they won 14 of the first 19. Is that fair to give Solskjaer a bit of a pass? Because you can't get away from the fact that he still was in charge for what was one of the worst performances that club has turned in the last 25 years on Sunday afternoon.
No, I don't believe you can give the Manchester United manager a pass. I think if you're a manager of an iconic club like that, you should be able to solve problems. Listen, I'm not shying away from the fact that this group of players are reverting to type. The very fact that over the last couple of seasons, they look like they're going to finish sixth again this season. So that's 2 6th-place finishes in 3 seasons. This is Manchester United, huge investment. And I think the very fact now that they've got a cult figure in charge, they've got great tradition, that's not enough. Coupled with the money that they've invested, it's not enough. They're way behind the likes of Liverpool and Manchester City. And it has been interesting to lose 6 of the last 8 games. I would expect, if you played the 8 best teams in the world, I wouldn't expect United to lose 6 of those games. So there's a massive problem. There's a group of players who are ultimately, and we said this even during that brilliant run under Solskjaer, that he would have to review it. That there's a lot of those players who are not of the Manchester United quality required to get them back to where they belong. And they've proved it. They've reverted to type, and there's a massive rebuilding job. And you have to say whether or not he's got a body of work behind him as a manager to suggest he can fix this problem.
Why do you think, from you looking on at it, Gary, it has gone so badly wrong over the last few weeks? And yes, you know, two of those defeats have been against Barcelona. One has been against Paris Saint-Germain. They've gone to Arsenal and lost. But at the same time, they've lost twice to Wolves and they've lost to Everton as well. So you can't really write them off. What has happened? The effort that has been put in by the players is something that Gary Neville questioned in stark terms at the weekend. And that was one of the things that we saw a huge upturn in, the pressing game, the intensity that they brought to their games. As soon as Solskjaer got the job, they were like a different team. Why have they reverted to type? Whatever about the quality, whatever about the issues with the personnel at the back, you probably wouldn't pick any of that back for a top six side. But it's the effort and the application that has reverted to type. How and why has that happened under Solskjaer?
Because ultimately, this is what these players are about. They lack consistency. And when I always think about Manchester United players, there's been great players before who haven't excelled at United, haven't been able to cope, because you have to play week in, week out. You're the biggest show in town when you come along. You're the team everyone wants to be. There's this drive that you come from the other players that you have to perform, not only on the Saturday, but you hear the quotes now, people saying, you know, the stories of Manchester United saying that you're a Manchester United player 24 hours a day. And these players just can't cope with it. It's as simple as that. On their day, yeah, there's some fantastic players in that squad, but it's a lack of consistency. That's the big gulf, that they cannot do it week in, week out. And you say, why has it suddenly happened? It was inevitable it was going to happen, because this is the character of these players. And now everyone will say, listen, you can't question their ability. No, at times I can't. They are fantastically gifted technical players. But there's no doubt I can question their work ethic, their attitude, their desire to just be footballers and nothing else.
Before we focus specifically on the game tonight, there was a couple of interesting statements from Solskjaer in the build-up to this derby game, where he admitted that he feels United are unlikely to contend for the title next season. He said, let's see, never say never, but we're so long away from it.
He's changing his tone now, isn't he?
Well, that's
changing
his tone. Yeah, that's the question. Like, it's hardly a profound statement. We can all see that United are miles away from being a title contender next season. And you can see how far off the top two they are at the moment. But all the same, Gary, it's a far cry from the statements he was making 6 weeks ago. We are Manchester United. We're expected to win games. We're expected to come from behind late on and steal 3 points. We are expected to win Premier League. This is what this club is all about. When he got the job originally, and now he's telling Manchester United fans, you know, don't be going into next season with any expectations. This is a long-term job. It's a very different Solskjaer now in terms of what he's saying to the supporters when he was making all the right noises just 6 weeks ago.
It's very much like, you know, a party before an election, you know, and then they get voted in. It's like, nah, well, you know, we did promise that, but, you know, let's be honest, we don't have it.
Listen, it's exactly that. And you say about he's changing in terms of his tone. Visibly, he's changing. He looks withered already in terms of that that bounce that he had. And I know, listen, by winning games, that changes things. But you're right, and I'm glad you've identified it. And I'm sure that an educated Manchester United group of fans will do. They know they've got their fans' favourite in charge, but suddenly they'll be starting to ask questions. Hold on a minute. You said about Manchester United, we'll get back to this. Now, all of a sudden, no, it's going to be a lot longer than I thought. That would be concerning. And I think it shows you how quickly things change in football. About a month ago, everyone's saying that Solskjaer's a man, Pochettino's seeing Tottenham's title chance collapse with just 1 point from 15. Fast forward to now, Pochettino's got a team with no investment to the Champions League semi-finals, a very good chance of beating an Ajax team over two legs. And Solskjaer's lost 6 out of 8 games. Just shows you things change very quickly.
There's an element of him playing politics as well, isn't there, Gary, in the sense of how well he managed sort of the media and the fans in that honeymoon period when he hadn't gotten the job. And now you see that sea change when he knows that he has the time, or certainly has the contract to say, well, let's dampen expectations here and kind of change the narrative.
You're right there. And one of the other things that was noticeable, certainly in that defeat to Everton, was the fact that they didn't get off the bench. He was not demonstrative at all. He just sat there and just let it unfold. Now, I'm certainly one of those coaches, players who expects the players to take care of business when they cross that line. But nevertheless, you want a manager cajoling, demanding. There's no way Ferguson would have sat down there. And he keeps referencing Alex Ferguson wouldn't accept it. And I'm just thinking, come on, man, just have your own identity a bit. I know in terms of he's your mentor and stuff like that, but just stop banging that drum, because you've got the job on the back of it to a certain extent. And some brilliant results, listen, take nothing away from it. He's galvanised that whole club in that period. But this is the real test now, going from a temporary manager to a permanent one. And I'm just looking at situations thinking, this don't look like it's going to go the way they hoped.
I was at Ultra, or at Goodison Park, for off the ball. And that day, Everton beat Manchester United. I think it was 3-0 under David Moyes. It was the day the Grim Reaper was standing in full costume behind David Moyes at Goodison Park. And I won't lie to you, Gary, last Sunday felt very similar. The way that they were completely outplayed, both in terms of the application but the actual skill as well, and the beleaguered manager on the sideline. And that was at the end of a long, tough season for David Moyes where nothing seemed to go right for him. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is only in this job 16 weeks now at this stage. It's you do fear for him if he can't get it turned around quickly. And from a Manchester United fan point of view, I'm sure some of them would say that the honeymoon period at the beginning of next season has now been dramatically shortened. Would you agree with that? That if they don't finish top four, having almost miraculously found themselves in a position to contend for that, suddenly Solskjaer will find a couple of bad results at the beginning of next season, and maybe his legendary status at the club won't be enough to keep the fans from howling for his name to be maybe thrown out of the club.
Oh no, listen, he has to win games as Manchester United manager. Everyone does, regardless of whether or not you're a fan's favourite. But you're right, I think you're spot on there. I think how they finish this season has a massive effect on how well the start of next season goes. And I would agree with you. I think you're getting a lot of people now who are criticising him, saying, well, listen, he's playing a defensive style of football that's not that different to Mourinho. He'll play defensive tonight. And I can understand that tactic. Certainly, they'll look to suck City onto them. And the very fact that City are vulnerable to quick counter-attacks and United have that pace in those advanced areas to hurt them. But even Van Gaal is saying now that he's playing Mourinho-style football. They're all having their little bit. There's no doubt Jose Mourinho is looking at this situation for Solskjaer and saying, listen, I told you about these players. This is what I've had to put up with, that you just can't rely on them. So it's a massive end of the season for Solskjaer. I think he'll want to finish on a positive. If he can get in that Champions League, that would be incredible in terms of the rebuild job they need to entice the top players back into United with Champions League football. But I think it's a huge game tonight.
You see a kind of a mass purge of some of those players in the off-season, Gary?
Yeah, without a doubt. And not just because Solskjaer coming in and these results. You have to ultimately say, and it doesn't take anyone to have to work with them day in, day out to know that they're not good enough to get Manchester United back to where they belong. That's challenging for the title. Pat Nevins always gives you really a good, honest appraisal of things. And the very fact that he said, how many of those players would you want? How many of those players would the top teams, Liverpool and City, want? There wouldn't be many of them.
Well, one maybe two. Like, they did give Phil Jones a new four-year contract. You wonder what the thinking is behind that, for example. I'm not just singling out Phil Jones, but it's an indication of the overall mindset of the hierarchy at Old Trafford. Several high-profile managers now have come and gone. They've been unable to halt this slide since Ferguson left. Yes, they haven't been doing the best of jobs, Van Gaal and Mourinho in particular, but at the same time, the way the club is being run, you wonder when or if heads would roll as regards how the transfer policy has been put in place. They don't seem to be delivering in the academy anymore either. It's a club that is in dire need of a complete refit, but on the pitch and off it as well. An interesting one for you, Gary. We put a poll up on Twitter, as we love to do around these parts, and it was two Manchester United fans. Would you rather one of the three scenarios tonight, rising out of tonight's game, lose and Liverpool's Premier League title aspirations pretty much gone, because you would expect City to get the job done after that, win and pretty much hand the title to Liverpool, or draw, barely keep the top four alive, but you've scuppered City's chances of winning the title and you've pretty much scuppered your top four chances as well. And the results, I don't know if they're surprising, but they're definitely interesting. 33%. Exactly a third of Manchester United fans would rather see United lose tonight and Liverpool be out of the title race. You could say, you know, anything can happen, but almost certainly out of the title race. 46% want to see Manchester United win and hand Liverpool the title, but still be in a great position to finish in the top four. And 21% a draw, keep the top four alive, but at the same time, you're pretty much giving Liverpool the title. What are your thoughts on that, Gary? You're probably not surprised.
It also should be shown here that you don't have to be a Manchester United fan to vote, and I think a lot of Liverpool fans have definitely voted in this.
Yeah,
hijack
the
poll, because it's way more than 33%. It's like, it was a line that I read yesterday in the papers, like 95% of Liverpool or Man United fans would admit to you that they don't want Liverpool to win the title, and the other 5% are lying, basically. And that's what this is like.
What do you think,
Gary?
Well,
I would have, that is exactly what I would have backed. That United do not want Liverpool to win this title. They're so precious in terms of the amount of Premier League titles. They're obviously at each other all the time over that. They're at each other in terms of European Cup wins. But I it's just a horrible scenario for United every way they look, isn't it? It's such a dilemma. And I don't know, I look at the scenario now, I know that United can produce a performance out of nothing in terms of that. I know that City are vulnerable defensively in terms of those quick turnovers. Tottenham proved that, proved it again at the weekend, had numerous chances. The likes of John Stones wouldn't trust to keep them out. They don't read situations quick enough. But I just don't know. You still think, even without De Bruyne, that City will have too much for United tonight?
Yeah, you would think United are going to need 15 points if they're going to be finishing in the top four from the five games that they
have. Well, listen, this is the problem. I thought it was a nap that they were going to get in the top four, bearing in mind that Arsenal and Chelsea were having their struggles in terms of the inconsistencies.
Yeah, like the position they got themselves in.
Yeah, for them to have thrown it away literally now, Solskjaer. I know the very fact that Arsenal lose at home to Palace, but you still expect them to probably nick that last four spot, bearing in mind the games have got less. Having said that, they're going to Leicester away from home. They're shocking away from home. Leicester have the type of pace that can hurt Arsenal's defence, but Tottenham nailed on for that third position. That was a massive win against Brighton last night.
Yeah, you think those defeats at Wolves and Everton, I mean, they picked up 2 points on the six on offer in those games. They'd been in a really good position to finish top four, given that they have Chelsea this afternoon and that game is live and off the ball this Sunday afternoon. Couple of other quick things, Gary, before we leave you. You've mentioned that win last night for Tottenham. Big goal, great goal from Christian Eriksen, who's hitting his top form just at the right time ahead of that two-legged tie with Ajax in the Champions League semi-finals. The point would have been brilliant for Brighton. Do you still see them as favourites to beat Cardiff to that 17th position? Or are they just showing a real inability to dig out results at the moment? And if Cardiff can get one more, and they have a couple of very winnable games, most notably home to Crystal Palace, that Brighton come that final day against Man City, they might need something from that game.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's a huge point against Wolves. You say about the game against Palace. Palace are so good away from home at the moment. They've got more results away from home than they have at home. But it's a massive game, Newcastle at home on Saturday. They can put everything to bed now for Brighton. But the problem that they have is that's 7 games now without a goal. They're no goal threat. And it's all well and good playing that defensive style and something we've seen with Ireland, defending on the edge of your box, making it difficult, making Duffy and Dunk look great players. But you need to be a goal threat, and they haven't been. So I think they will survive Brighton, but I think it'll be a case of the season running out too quick for Cardiff, who've actually done a great show in terms of their first season back in the Premier League. But everyone's talking about Brighton. There's a little bit of criticism, and you can sense it as well with these new guys that they've brought in, that they're trying to convince, we've heard murmurings out of the changing room, they're trying to convince Chris Hughton to play a more expansive, more attack-minded game. They can't. They play that way, they'd be ripped to pieces. There's no doubt about that. It suits them playing defensively the way they are, but they've just got to be more of a goal threat somehow.
Yeah, I think they're 3 points clear. They have a vastly superior goal difference to Cardiff City. So Brighton will have to drop points in 2 games. Cardiff need to make up 4 points against them, up against Brighton, really.
Brighton have to get something against Newcastle, because I won't back them to get anything against Arsenal City in their last 2 games.
A point there, I think, and Brighton should be okay. But you say it's a case of maybe Cardiff running out of games, then Brighton doing anything that really sees them deserve to actually stay in the Premier League. Before you go, the Player of the Season nominations came out a couple of days ago. First time we've had a chance to talk to you about it since. City obviously dominating the six-man shortlist for the PFA Player of the Year. Van Dijk, Raheem Sterling, the two front runners. Sadio Mane is also on the list. Sergio Aguero, Bernardo Silva as well, and Eden Hazard. Who would you have?
Well, listen, the difficulty about this, and of course the timing of it as well, is that ultimately you want to make your decision based on who wins the league. I know I don't want to go down the likes of like the MVP in American football as such, but this is the one occasion that you'd be reluctant to announce it. If you're saying to me right now, I would still go with Van Dijk. I think the influence he's had on Liverpool is incredible, the amount of clean sheets. I think they've had 18 as a team. I think he's been in the team for 17 of them. He's elevated that Liverpool team. But then I'd counter that by saying Raheem Sterling has just gone to a completely different level in terms of his goals, assists. I think the only way you probably look at it for me, I would probably give it to Van Dijk, Player of the Year. Sterling, still young Player of the Year. But then with honourable mentions to the likes of Sadio Mane at Liverpool in terms of picking up the mantle in terms of when Salah was struggling for goals. Also Bernardo Silva, what he's done at City as well in terms of driving them forward, covering the loss of De Bruyne. The very fact that Mahrez has come in for a big money signing, he's been able to bat him away. And then other young players you have to give a mention to would obviously be Declan Rice at West Ham.
We've
got to take that away. We've got to be professional, Johnny. Ooh. We're talking about performances.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It's an interesting one, the young player.
Where's
the
that jar for me to throw some money
at? I mean, if Sterling and Silva, if Van Dijk wins the Player of the Year award, Sterling or Silva obviously must win the Young Player of the Year award. Yeah, Trent Alexander-Arnold is in there. Brooks at Bournemouth is a brilliant season, is there. Declan Rice, yeah. But Marcus Rashford also, and I really couldn't see him win it, but it's an interesting one. It's is it something that should be left until the end of the season, Gary? Because you did liken it to the Super Bowl situation, and you know, so much goes as to who wins the Vince Lombardi trophy at the end of that game, as to who's going to be winning the MVP. I would agree with you that if you lead your side to the title, which is going to be the case for either Raheem Sterling or Virgil van Dijk, you win it then.
Yeah, listen, in this instance, for these two particular teams, now I've seen other teams win the title, and I've still identified that someone had a better player of the year team performance over the season elsewhere. But in this instance, it seems so apt that we would have to wait in terms to see who was the definitive winner as such in terms of the teams. And I think it's a difficult one. The only problem is that when you're a player, you get these ballots sent out to you around February time. So you've got to make a decision February, beginning of March. There's still so much of the season to play. The business end of the season when it matters most. So more often than not, the timings of these is based on when the vote is actually done.
Okay, one more question. Shane Long scored last night. It's his third in four games. I think it's as good a run of form goal-scoring-wise as Shane Long has been. Certainly going back to his Reading days and maybe going back to his very first days in the Premier League. Jeff Hendrick, brilliant volley against Chelsea Monday night.
Yeah,
we've seen the Sheffield United boys go brilliant in front of goal. Conor Harran's thrown in a couple of absolute purrs in this incredible run that Aston Villa have been on. I don't know if you heard Johnny waxing lyrical about the atmosphere, the quality of the football at the Talis Stadium last night. We've had two UCD starlets earning trials at Manchester City. New management team in place. Two wins from two in the Euro 2020 qualifiers. Irish football, Gary, has never been in better health than it is right now.
Well, certainly not over the last 2 years it hasn't. No, but long may it continue.
What about Shane Long? I mean, this is perfect timing for our point of view going into those June games. He's been missing both with injury, and when he has been playing, he's really just struggled to score goals for us. We wonder where the goals are coming from. It would leave you feeling very optimistic given the form of the likes of McGoldrick, Shane Long, Conor Harran, the return to form to Seamus Coleman as well, going into these matches and then into the autumn when Mick McCarthy's fate as Ireland manager in this campaign will be decided.
Well, listen, it's great in terms of Shane Long. He's had a tough time as such, and it was a typical goal of his last night in terms of his work, his endeavour to close it down, and then what a brilliant finish as well. He talked about Ben Foster having been with him at West Brom, how good he is at spreading himself. But that little dink finish was brilliant. So his confidence will be high. There's no doubt Hasenhüttl going into Southampton's had a big bearing on him and a lot of other Southampton players. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot of confidence going into it, into the summer. And, you know, I'll look forward to those games now. They're always difficult games because there's a big lull, normally 3 or 4 weeks between playing. It looks like those Sheffield United guys now will get automatic promotion as opposed to going through the playoffs. So it does bode well, and I'm great. I'm delighted to see it.
Call that game tonight. Give us a result.
2-1 City.
And then City to win the league.
I know everyone's saying win this game, but I think Burnley is a tough game. I think it's a tough game for them. It will test them, but I think if they can get past United tonight, then I think it's there for them, no doubt.
Okay, Gary, brilliant as always. Thanks a million.
Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
See you, Gary.
Gary Breen on the Manchester Derby tonight. I did feel before the Tottenham game that it was a 5-day title race. If City beat Tottenham and Man U, they're going to win the league. Yes, Burnley, they're safe now. They've not to play for, really. But it's such an awkward spot to go up and play in, and Burnley would love to turn City over.
Mm. I just don't see them slipping up. No, I wouldn't underestimate Newcastle against Liverpool in St James's Park. I think Newcastle are in good nick at the moment. Now, again, does Rafa really want Newcastle to beat Liverpool? But I could see Newcastle putting it up to Liverpool. I just don't see Man City not winning their games. And I have no faith in Man United whatsoever tonight and really hope I'm wrong. Have to attend, sounds like a bit of a chore now, have to attend an off-the-ball racing Punchtown gathering tonight at the Alexander Hotel. But a few people will have their eyes on them. On what's going on in the game.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have much interest in knowing what the score is. I have no faith in Man United getting out of the game tonight.
You're just lowering expectations so that you'll be wonderfully surprised if United get a point and maybe that 29-year drought will come to an end.
Yeah, I'd feel very sorry for Liverpool if they didn't win the title this season, because that point tally is absolutely incredible, and they fought, you know, wars on multiple fronts. They've gotten to the Champions League semi-finals after coming through a very ropey group stages, and the style of their football has been great. You know, I would argue that if you give their front three marks out of 10 managed at a great season. Firmino and Salah, they can probably play a lot better. And, you know, they have a very functional midfield that you wouldn't say is outstanding. And despite that, they could get 97 points this season. A lot of it down to Alisson and obviously Van Dijk.
Yeah, they've been the team of the season, I think. And I think for the Premier League as well, it would be brilliant. I mean, if Liverpool win the title this season, that's five winners in seven seasons.
Yeah, which
is incredible.
It's
you talk about
incredible.
La Liga, you talk about the Bundesliga. It's a farce in France. PSG usually have it wrapped up 7 or 8 weeks before the end of the season. Between United, City, Liverpool, Chelsea and Leicester, if Liverpool were to win the title this season. 5-7 is unprecedented. I don't think people appreciate how competitive the Premier League is at the moment. You've got four teams looking for two spots in the top six. Yes, relegation looks like it's probably going to be decided maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the end of the season, but unless Cardiff can pull out a couple of big victories. Mm. But it's going to be a really exciting next few weeks. But, I mean, to have 5-7 would be something else. I'm going to give you an opportunity to get involved in our Leia competition this morning. We've teamed up with Leia Healthcare, the official health and wellbeing partner to Leinster Rugby, to launch Wellbeing Wednesday. For the past 7 weeks or so, one lucky winner each week has won a Blue Book voucher worth €250 for their very own wellbeing retreat. We're picking out our eighth winner today and then our final Blue Book winner next week. Then all nine winners will then go into a draw and one of you will receive a Leia Healthcare wellbeing hamper and a Leinster season ticket for the 2019-2020 season. To enter, simply answer this question: who did Leinster beat in the 2014 Pro 12 final? It's a tough enough question, but we will give you a hint. It was Brian O'Driscoll's final game for the province. I can't think of it off the top of my head. I'd have to have a think about it. Send us your answer on any of our OTB social channels and make sure you use the hashtag It's Good to Live. So that's our Leia Healthcare competition. Who did Leinster beat in the 2014 Pro 12 final? OK, it is 8:41 on Wednesday morning on OTBAM. Whether you're listening to us in the old school form, radio, on otb.com, offtheball.com, or you're watching us here on any of our social media channels, this is OTBAM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. Phil Egan is going to pop into us next, but first, here's Ken Doherty chatting to Joe about Ronnie O'Sullivan crashing out at the Crucible yesterday.
This is not only probably in snooker, but one of the biggest shocks in sport. I mean, you had Ronnie O'Sullivan, probably the best cueist that's ever played the game, best player. And after the season that he's had, winning five tournaments out of only, I think he's only played in 10 tournaments this year. So he's coming in with overwhelming favour for the tournament, never mind with the first round match. It wasn't a foregone conclusion like everybody thought it was going to be, because with Ronnie O'Sullivan, you just never know. In the first session, he was like terrible. You know, it was like that. He was treating the match like an exhibition. Don't know how ill he was. He said he had a bit of a virus. Looked like he hadn't got a lot of sleep. But he played really very, very loosely, very casual. And and James Cahill didn't balk at the opportunity. He grabbed the situation with both hands and he played superbly well at the end. He didn't look well in the chair, but even if you're not well, you know, we've all played when we haven't been well, the virus and stuff like that. But it's not that. It's just the attitude when you're playing the game itself and the application of playing the right shots and not sort of treating it as like a sort of an exhibition match. You're playing in the World Championships, you know. You don't go for ridiculous shots like and just treat it like it doesn't matter whether they go in or not. That would be my assumption of the way he played in that first session. Right. And maybe he just sometimes with Ronnie, he's just not up for the fight, you know, and he just didn't look up for the fight. And maybe because of his health, maybe because he felt very, very unwell. And that's his prerogative, you know.
And does it appear to be, I don't know if you've spoken to him about it, is chasing the Henry world title record a big motivation for him?
I would say that's his only motivation now, you know.
Right.
I would say that's all he wants to now achieve before he eventually retires.
Yeah, that was Ken Doherty chatting to Joe about Ronnie O'Sullivan's demise in Sheffield yesterday. Phil Egan has joined us for this morning's sports news. Good morning.
Morning, lads.
On Ronnie, I know you're a snooker fan. I don't think Ronnie O'Sullivan gives two hoots as to whether or not he reaches seven Crucible World titles and joins Stephen Hendry on that mark. I certainly don't think that is something that remotely keeps Ronnie O'Sullivan awake at night.
No, like, I've never really seen a player that kind of almost criticises his own sport so much. You know, he wins tournaments. He's famously won tournaments and almost belittles the sport as he's picking up the cheque, saying, ah, you know, I needed the cheque because the kid's school is quite expensive. Mm. And then he, like his interview after, he was quite downbeat, low energy. Now, I know he does a lot of running. I'm wondering, did he just do too much running before the lead up to the tournament?
Yeah, he said he wasn't feeling well. Yeah. He couldn't quite put his finger on what it was.
But he tried to cut his hair even in between sessions. It didn't work for him.
Yeah, Ken kind of hit the nail on the head there. Sometimes you just wonder if Ronnie's up for the fight at all, and you just don't really know what sort of headspace he's in when he comes. And as Ronnie himself said yesterday, the Crucible is a marathon. We've seen players really struggle mentally. I remember Graham Dott, who has suffered in that regard over the last few years. He's a former champion, talking about what it does to you mentally those 2 weeks, the grind of the sessions, and you know the 35 frame matches in the semis, yeah, and the finals. And if you're not physically and mentally at the very top of your game, you're not going to survive there.
Now, when you think back to Ronnie when he lost that final to Selby, he was in unbelievable form, but Selby ground him down. Mm. And that's what Selby's brilliant as a match player of doing that. He has mental toughness that he can do it, but it's just put the draw wide open. I'd say a few people perked up when the hair Ronnie was gone. 8-all, he got back from 8-5, and when he got to 8-all, you know, it looks like he's going to win from there. Mm. And he misses the most routine pink. If one of us missed it, lads, you'd be disgusted.
I don't think mine. I don't think I'd be surprised if I missed it. The big thing is that he's no longer in the tournament for me, and I probably won't watch any of the snooker over the next fortnight because Ronnie's not there.
Ah, no, there'll be some good matches.
I have this debate with my mates at times about snooker. It's kind of a philosophical debate, but it's also a debate on how good you would be at snooker, because we all play pool and, you know, after a few pints, whatever, and it's grand, but then you go to a snooker table and you're like, oh, here, this is huge. So consider the scenario, right? You're playing like one of the pros. The black is basically in the black position, the white ball, the black's the only ball left, and you're 8 points up, right? And the black is the only ball left, and you're playing a professional, and he's taken the white off the cushion. He's to hit the black. So all you have to do is keep hitting the black. I'd fancy him to beat me. I think he'd play some sort of a snooker situation. Not even a snooker situation.
But he can't.
But he'd just put the black so far away, he'd have the white on the cushion, yeah, and eventually I'd miss it. That's how bad I am at snooker anyway. But I'd like to see people listening in. Do they fancy themselves of, if they're 8 points up with only the black left, would they still be the professional? I wouldn't.
That's fascinating, yeah. Conundrum. Next time Ken is in Dublin, yeah, we need to get him in here. Well, not in here, literally. We don't have a snooker.
The studio's not big enough.
But we need to get this filmed, and we need to put you up against Ken with an 8-point lead and only the black left, black on its spot, cue ball up against the back cushion in the bulk area. And let's see if Ken can actually turn that around. Yeah. You would consider that one of his greatest professional achievements. Phil, where are you going?
OK, we're going to start with the Dublin Derby. Almost 6,500 were in Tala last night. Cracking atmosphere. Bohemians have done it again. They toppled Shamrock Rovers. They've won 6 of the last 7 against Rovers. A 1-0 win. All the talking points came in the first half. Rovers had Trevor Clark and Lee Grace sent off in that first half. Grace was shown a second yellow for a handball in the penalty area. Now, I was watching this on TV. It took a lot of replays before I realised it actually struck him in the face. It looked like it had hit his hand.
There's a nice photo of it here, and you can see just in the back, the endo. And I think that's the best photo you have of in defensively, Grace. Yep. But he's a great lad, and in fairness, he was adamant, you know. But everyone in the ground thought it was a handball.
Well, it was the defining moment of the game, because whatever about the Trevor Clark sending off, it's a penalty. Alan Manis saves it from Dinny Corcoran, but he taps in the rebound. So Bows are up to second. They're 5 behind Rovers, who've played a game more. And Corcoran says the odds were firmly in their favour with an extra 2 men.
I don't think I've ever played 11v9, to be honest with you, especially so early in the game as well, with more than an hour nearly with 2 extra men. So obviously it's a huge advantage. It's very hard to play against 11 when you've only 9. So look, we still kept the ball well, we had the job to do, and we've done it professionally, and we're delighted.
So that is the Dublin Derby. Tonight it's all about the Manchester Derby, and it could well decide where the Premier League trophy finishes up at the end of the season. City will go top if they beat United at Old Trafford, but if they don't, it's in Liverpool's hands with 3 games to play. Ander Herrera is expected to be available once again. He's been out for 4 weeks with a thigh injury. Luke Shaw returns from suspension. No Kevin De Bruyne for City. United have lost 6 of their last 8 games. They were beaten 4-0 by Everton on Sunday. But manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer thinks this game is actually an ideal one to bounce back.
That's the best game we could ask for now. With players hurt, the City game is the perfect one. There's no hiding place on the pitch. I've said it so many times, and our fans, they will back you as long as you give that effort. And against the City side, that's been very, very good. We've got to turn up.
That game kicks off at 8 o'clock. Arsenal are away to Wolves at 7:45. A draw would actually be enough for Arsenal to move back up to fourth place. They've only won 6 away games in the league all season. Tottenham have a 3-point lead in third place thanks to their 1-0 win at home to Brighton. Christian Eriksen with the goal in the 88th minute. Shane Long is on fire. Officially, he's on fire again. The last time I can remember Shane Long being on fire was before the Euros, and Irish fans were singing Shane Long's on fire at the Euros, but he didn't score. But he has scored 3 goals in 4 games, scored in the 1-1 draw away to Watford last night, but this one goes down in the record books because it's the quickest goal in Premier League history. 7.69 seconds is all it took for him to score, and he says he was just following the manager's orders.
Every game you try and put them under pressure, show your intent from the first kickoff. Try to force that long ball with a bit of pressure so that we have the best opportunity to win it back. Luckily I managed to block it, it fell nicely. I know Ben from West Brom, he's an amazing keeper. He spreads himself so well and he's out at you quick. And I knew from before the game that the dink finish was the best option.
Yeah. It's a mad game, you know, for a lad who's such a struggle to score, and then you score the fastest goal in Premier League history. And there's a real kind of I haven't gone away, you know, element about Shane Long at the moment. That just telling Mick, you know, I should still be in your thoughts.
Yeah, he's Hasenhüttl's main man now. He's keeping them up. They're going to stay up because
I always
goals.
Thought he would suit a manager that plays a pressing game because he'll run all day for you.
Yeah.
And you just, it always comes back to put him under pressure.
And he's going to find himself closer to goal more often and his team winning the ball in better areas more often.
Yeah.
As you say, that suits Shane Long down to the ground.
He's a totally different player to McGoldrick as well in terms of trying to mix it up a bit. And for a lad who's advanced a bit in years, he hasn't really lost much of his pace. You know, he still has that option.
And for a player that has had so many hamstring injuries, he still is an absolute flyer. But yeah, Irish strikers in decent form. You mentioned McGoldrick. He scored a cracking goal there the other day as well. Scored 2 goals. James Collins scored his 24th goal for Luton last night.
And dare I say it, like, Leeds have blown it at this stage by the looks of it. And Sheffield United really should be in the Premier League next season.
But they're 3 points clear, 2 games to go, and they've superior goal difference.
Leeds result was incredible on Saturday.
An implosion.
It was just an absolute implosion.
Yeah, the Wigan one, yeah, absolutely. We mentioned Ronnie O'Sullivan. Well, Judd Trump is now one of the favourites for the World Snooker Championship because of O'Sullivan's first round exit. But Trump is in trouble. He's 6-3 down to Thailand's Thepchea Unnao, and that first round match will continue later on. Antrim's Mark Allen has a mountain to climb. 7-2 down to China's Zhu Yulong. And you mentioned Graham Dott. He almost staged a remarkable comeback. He was 8-1 down to Stuart Bingham. It went to a decider. Bingham won 10-9.
Two former champions, right?
Yeah. And Dublin beat Meath by 4-10 to 2-10 at Parnell Park in the opening round of the Leinster Minor Football Championship last night. There were also wins for Louth, Offaly, Kildare and Westmeath. Carlo and Leash finished 11 points apiece.
Okay, brilliant. So, Phil, thanks a million. Our producer, Tommy, was at that game last night at Parnell Park, said it was a really good game, good advertising for the, what is now the under-17 grades. That's the first round of the Leinster Minor Football Championship. We mentioned earlier, to mark the launch of Liverpool's new 2019-2020 home jersey, which is dedicated to Bob Paisley. There it is for anyone watching us on our social channels. It's actually a very nice jersey. We've got a jersey to give away every day this week in OTB AM. The new kit is available to pre-order online and at the official LFC store in the Ilex Centre ahead of its official launch on the 9th of May, when it will also be available to purchase in store and online. Well, we have the first actual jersey in Ireland in the studio here on OTB AM. To win this morning's jersey, just tell us which Liverpool manager brought Fernando Torres to the club. Which Liverpool manager brought Fernando Torres to the club? Get in touch with us on any of our social media channels to have a chance of winning that jersey. OK, we're going to switch codes now to Gaelic games and a very interesting story that's emanating from Donegal Club Football. To bring us through the detail, I'm going to welcome Chris McNulty, sports writer for Donegal Sports. So, good morning, Chris. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Thanks, Dave.
I said earlier that when we get these sort of PR issues, that the tendency for a lot of people is to immediately launch two-footed into the GAA, try and throw it into the same category as the Liam Miller game situation down in Cork, to the Newbridge or Nowhere situation. So I think it's probably good that we get the detail. Naoimh Columbkill, which we should say is your local club up in Donegal, they're at the centre of a situation whereby they have been banned from staging adult games for 8 weeks. They've been fined €500 for breaching rule 6.40 of the GAA codebook, which basically says you cannot play any unauthorised tournaments. What happened was there was a charity event launched for a local man who was diagnosed with motor neuron disease late in 2018. A game of football, a game of seven-a-side broke out on one of the Nave Columbkill pitches. Let me know if there are any inaccuracies there and have I summed up the situation.
Yeah, that's perfectly right, Dave. There was a fundraising drive back in February. There was a weekend-long series of events to raise money to refurbish the home of Paul Dillon, a local man in Newton Cunningham who received the devastating diagnosis of motor neuron disease late in 2018. Guy who's at the hub of the community, who was at the heart of the GA club for a long number of years, has coached so many of us back in our underage days, back in the 90s, from really the rebirth of the club in the mid-1990s, Paul Dillon was at the centre of it. So as part of this weekend's long fundraising drive, there was a tournament organised, I should say, by an independent local committee headed up by the local councillor, Paul Canning, who sought permission from the GA club to use their facilities at Park Columbkill as part of the fundraiser. And the club, I suppose, sought permission initially from Croke Park and were turned down late in that week, and sought also, I believe, permission from the Donegal County Board and were turned down also. But at some point on the weekend, I think the club sort of decided to do possibly the neighbourly thing and do the decent thing. And, you know, I just made the point to Tommy, the producer, just before I joined, you know, there's uproar now on one level, but can you imagine, Dave, the uproar locally in a small local community if the GA club had refused to give their facility for such a fundraiser?
Yeah, there would be a very different debate going on in the local area. I understand that completely. So what were the grounds on which the application to stage this tournament, and it seems to only have been one game, it's not quite that it was even a tournament, but what were the grounds on which both by the GA and by the Donegal County Board that Nave Columbkill were refused permission to actually allow this game to take place?
Yeah, so I suppose as well as Rule 6.40 of the official guide, which deals with unauthorised tournaments, Nave Columbkill have also actually been sanctioned under Rule 5.1, which deals with the use of property, and basically it's only for the purposes of playing Gaelic games. Now, there's suggestions that there was a game or games of soccer played on the field, but my understanding is when the club made the application initially, it was as a fundraiser. And I think what I'm led to believe is it was turned down on the grounds that it wasn't a fundraiser. It wasn't a GA fundraiser. So it was a fundraiser for an external body. So basically, had the club disguised this as a GA club's fundraiser, and a few days later the club committee presented a cheque to this fundraising committee for Paul Dillon, then I believe it wouldn't have been an issue. So the fact that it wasn't a GAA function or a GAA tournament or GA fundraiser, then that's where the problem lay.
On the face of it, you know, it's another PR disaster, and to say that it's a PR disaster for Croke Park is probably a bit premature, but given that this specific issue is, it's a million miles from Croke Park right now. They haven't been involved in any of the decision making. This is very much down to the Donegal County Board, and it is the County Board that will be involved in the appeals process as well, because we should say that Nave Columbkill are appealing the 8-week ban from all adult games taking place and the €500 fine. But the argument can be made, Chris, that there is a rule book, there is a code of conduct, there are guidelines in place by which the GA is run, and every organisation needs a rule book in place, otherwise anarchy and chaos reigns. Now, that does not suggest that we're remotely close to that in this situation. Is it not more of a case that it's the rule is the problem rather than the GA enforcing the rule book? Because the GA has to do that.
Yeah, I think, to be fair, I would have a degree of sympathy for the decision makers on the county board, given that the first issue here is that there was an official complaint and there was a number of items of correspondence sent to the Donegal County Board regarding this fundraiser. So when they get a complaint in writing or when they get pieces of correspondence like that, they're duty-bound as officers to act. And that's what they did. They consult the official guide. It's a pretty lengthy document. The rules are there in black and white. I suppose the issue may be that certain people have here is that if we go back to February and around about the same time as this fundraiser was happening, annual Congress was taking place, and the rules were changed somewhat following the Liam Miller debacle in Cork, whereby county grounds can now host non-Gaelic Games events or non-Gaelic Games functions. But that rule change doesn't go down to club level, so it doesn't cover the likes of Park Columbkill and Newton Cunningham to do similar as, you know, the Liam Miller function or the Liam Miller game in Parky Cueve, which was on a bigger scale, but I suppose along the same principles and along the same lines, it was a fundraiser for a certain cause.
I understand the point you're making about the Donegal County Board, that if someone has made this complaint to them, the rules are in place and they can't be seen to be picking and choosing what cases they rule on and what cases they just sweep under the carpet. Because, yes, this rule looks archaic and it looks completely unsuited for the purposes that it was put in place when you put it alongside the purpose of this fundraising campaign. I think €85,000 was raised, and for a parish of 1,500 people, that's extraordinary for what they've done for this man and for his family. But at the same time, it's something you would ask yourself, who are the people that have complained to the Donegal County Board that this game has taken place? And I'm not looking for names or anything, I don't even know if you know who these people are, but there are still people within the GAA that see it necessary to put on paper a complaint of this nature surrounding an event of this nature.
Yeah, that's for me. Look, you know, the rule book is one thing, but the rule and the archaic way it's written, or the archaic sort of way that it's put in the official guide, is a problem. But this is only a problem because its head has been raised by someone or by some people to the county board. To me, and I suppose it's maybe a very Irish thing to say, and you know, a very local thing to say, you know, we should have just turned a blind eye. But in reality, there was a guy here who gave his life and soul to his community, to his parish, to his club, and he received such a devastating illness. I mean, this guy is the butcher in the local shop. I mean, he's just sort of your quintessential Irish GA man. He's everything in the community. And there was a fundraising drive to make repairs to his home. It raised 85,000. This tournament itself raised over 5,000. I think 5,200 was the figure. It was just an amazing show of community strength. And now the unfortunate thing about it is we've got this man, Paul Dillon, who we're talking about and whose name is in headlines this morning for all the wrong reasons. I mean, this guy has gone through a tough enough battle, but now his name has been sort of, by association, dragged through by this unnecessary complaint. I would suggest, look, you know, again, I go back, the rules are there, the rules are quite clear, but there's sometimes maybe the unwritten rule of common sense should probably come into play.
I don't think the GAA should be totally vilified on this, you know, because the GAA...
Well, that's if we know that this was not initiated, that the whole process was not initiated, Chris, by the Donegal County Board.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if this was an external complaint, if this was someone from Naomh Columbkill or somebody that was at the game, a member of the public, it's a different story. Do we know whether it was the process was initiated in that manner, Chris, or was it the Donegal County Board and their disciplinary committees themselves that decided something needed to be put in motion here?
No, my information, Dave, is that the Donegal County Board acted on a complaint or complaints.
Okay. So that goes to your point, Johnny.
Yeah, like, yeah. And in fairness, Chris, whoever made the complaint, what his or her motivation is for this is kind of questionable at best. But you look at the FAI over the last month or so, and as archaic as the GAA is, it's a very democratic process. It has its flaws. It's probably belongs to another era in ways, but there's certainly an element of a lot of football people out there who'll be slating the dinosaur that is the GAA this morning on the base of this. But be very careful of what you wish for, and look what the FAI has done, and the GAA has an awful lot to be proud of and shouldn't be, I think, vilified for trying to stick by the rules, as archaic as they might be.
Yeah, it reminds me of the complaint that was made to the Garda Síochána on the back of the blasphemy that surrounded Stephen Fry at the time, where it was clearly a complaint in that occasion, I think, that was almost done tongue-in-cheek in a bid to actually just show publicly how archaic a law it was. But the Gardaí, they had to question Stephen Fry. They were left in no... They couldn't just decide, well, we deal with some complaints, we don't deal with others. They were duty-bound to see that process through to the end. And that's probably the situation with the Donegal County Board here. And without wishing to preempt the outcome of the appeal, Chris, do they have grounds on which they can appeal this? I'm sure there are people working for the club. Maybe there will be people acting as some sort of an intermediary in between as well to try and get the outcome that resembles common sense as closely as possible once this process has reached its conclusion.
Yeah, well, the club have requested a hearing. That hearing, I think, is possibly due to take place next week. Now, the club, as it stands, the club senior team have a game in Division 3 against St Mary's of Convoy this Sunday scheduled. That goes ahead. So basically, until this hearing, things motor on as normal, I suppose. But if we look at the rules and look at the way that the rules are written, they're quite clear. But I think, the club here is probably going to plead a certain element of just being neighbourly, of being sort of charitable. And I know maybe that sort of isn't in keeping with the way the rules are written or intended. It should also, I think, be noted on this that the grounds concerned are actually owned by the parish. They're vested in the GAA, yes, and everything from the front gate to the back hedge, I suppose, is vested within the GAA. But it is a community-owned facility, and when it was initially bought and initially developed, it was intended for the use of the whole community. And I suppose with events and with people like this in mind, that, again, it's a small community, Newton Cunningham, but the club deals, the club caters for people from four villages in the border area, and even putting all four villages together, it's still quite a small area. And going back to the development of the club and the development of the facility, it was intended as being for the community, the whole community. Again, that maybe doesn't fit with the GAA's rules, but it's possibly an angle that the club may go down in their appeal, that they're just maybe going to appeal to people's better judgment, perhaps.
Chris, thanks a million for taking the time to chat to us this morning.
No worries, guys.
That's Chris McNulty, a writer for the Donegal Sports Hub. It's a really sad situation, and here's a man who is now hearing his name being discussed in shows such as this. His name's been mentioned in a lot of the newspapers, both locally and nationally, and he probably thinks that some of the money that has been, much needed money that's been raised to help him in his fight to deal with the MND is tainted somewhat, and that's a really sad part of this. I don't blame the GAA for this. You could blame them for a couple of other things that have happened over the last year or so in terms of them struggling to get ahead of the story and the narrative. I certainly don't blame them for this one. I do blame the person or persons that have made this complaint. And I wonder how they're sleeping at night when they hear the story being discussed in this detail and they see the tweets from Eamon McGee and they see what they have caused by making such a petty, unnecessary, lacking in common sense and any sort of decency complaint to a Donegal County Board who now feel that they are bound to the rule book and have to see this through.
Yeah, I mean, certainly he or she isn't a person I'd be too happy or kind of buzzing to go for a pint with, considering the good that's been done here. And the prevalence of MND, the amount of times you hear of it, somebody being stricken with it and the difficulty it entails to go through with that debilitating disease. And for that person who just sounds like, as Chris was saying, a perfect sort of Gaelic Games character within the community, the butcher and all that, he didn't need this at all. He's enough of a battle ahead, and his family has. And yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, but I wouldn't be vilifying the GAA for trying to stick by its rules.
Yeah. OK, we're going to switch codes again. We're going to talk rugby. In a moment, we're going to look at the Champions Cup final meeting between Leinster and Saracens. I know it's 2.5 weeks away, but we haven't really got the Saracens and the English viewpoint and the fallout from the two semi-finals from a week ago. We're going to be speaking to Charlie Morgan of The Telegraph in a second. But first up, let's get to Ronan O'Gara, who was on off the ball yesterday. And he obviously had spent a lot of time analysing Munster's defeat to Saracens in that game at the Ricoh Arena. And in particular, Rog was focusing on the Munster fullback, Mike Haley, and how he was targeted, particularly in that first half.
I don't think Munster were in the game. They were in the game on the scoreboard, but I don't think they were in the game. They're writing kind of, not writing on the wall, but there was warning signs that Munster didn't win the air, and it's usually strong pointed of their game. I think within 12 minutes, Munster had lost 4 of the 5 high balls,
Yeah.
So they're things you control. They're not 50-50s. Spencer kicked them really accurately, but if you're a forward for Munster, it's a big learning day for Mike Haley at 15. And I think, you just get exposed against how accurate and a cup mentality team that Saracens were. They don't play that much rugby in terms of ball in hand, but their kicking game is exceptional. Their line speed is exceptional. I think their capacity to chase and play for each other is exceptional. So they get huge return out of that. But it's a bit of a tactical masterclass in that they all buy in and they agree to play it. And they get a return from each other because 80% of the high ball within the first 20 minutes, or 85, I would say 90%, was won by Saracens, which if you're not depriving them of their main strength, you're in for a long afternoon. So, Munster, as we said, were brave, but Saracens still were on the front foot for the whole game.
Yeah, they certainly were. Not in the game in the match itself, but very much on the scoreboard is how Rog looked at that. I think most people would agree with that. Yes, Munster, when they got that try in the second half, made it interesting for a few minutes, but you never felt that Saracens were really struggling in any way to keep complete control of that game. Let's talk to Charlie Morgan of The Telegraph. Good morning, sir. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Charlie, we've heard plenty from both Munster and Leinster, of course, and the fallout from the two semi-finals at the weekend. And today, Gordon Darcy's writing the Irish Times. He says this Champions Cup final against Saracens has a Game of Thrones feel to it. Johnny Sexton, immediately after the victory over Toulouse, said that this game with Saracens will be the biggest battle of mine and any of my teammates' careers. Huge statements. How is this final being described over there in the early aftermath of those two semi-finals?
Yeah, kind of to a similar scale. It's going to be really exciting. I think since Mark McCall's been building this kind of dynasty fairly gradually with Saracens since he took over in 2010-11, Leinster won those first two Champions Cups. Saracens gradually improved, gradually got more comfortable at that level. They obviously won back-to-back ones after Toulon's three in a row. And now for Leinster to have won this one last year leading into this year, it really kind of, I think I've seen it described as era-defining, and I think in terms of European rugby, it probably is. Really exciting. We could probably get into it later, but the head-to-heads all over the field, there are subplots absolutely everywhere. Absolutely fascinating.
From an EPCR point of view, Charlie, a Toulouse-Saracens final would have been an unmitigated disaster with the final being played at St James's Park, given that Toulouse brought 800 fans to Dublin on Sunday, and Saracens, who had, an hour and a half, two-hour journey up the road to the Rico, brought 4,000 fans with them. St James's Park would have been a bit of an eerie spot, I think, on finals day. Leinster getting there changes it completely. I don't know how many they'll bring, but it could be upwards of 20, 25,000 with them. And if Saracens bring 5 or 6,000 to the final, that will at least give the feel that St James's Park is full. Talk to me about Saracens as a club. I've done many games at Allianz Park. In the bleak midwinter, to borrow a phrase from Peaky Blinders, it can seem a fairly dreary and gloomy place. Is there a soul, is there a heart to this club that goes beyond the money that has been pumped into it and the sheer domination of these world-class players on the field?
I think so. I think it's kind of, it might be growing on the back of the success that they've had as clubs and on the back. I think the real soul within the club is the core of players that have grown through the academy, and I think maybe the crowds, they're hoping that the crowds come off the back of that gradually. I was at the Rico on Saturday, and it was a kind of very strange, kind of bizarre sort of situation. There were a few contributing factors to it. Sometimes Easter weekend, sometimes it just so happens that the semi-finals fall over Easter weekend. EPCR kind of have admitted that that's a occupational hazard. There were train scheduling problems. Rico Arena isn't the easiest. I think something to do with the regulations, they couldn't play at either Twickenham or Wembley because the aesthetics would have looked even worse. I think so. From what I hear, they have there has been a lot of interest from Saracens in the final, and you'd hope so, certainly. And I agree with you. It would have been an unmitigated disaster had it been Saracens versus Toulouse, but I feel like there will be certainly be an atmosphere at St James Park.
How are they viewed by non-Saracen supporters from clubs in the other parts of the Premiership, Charlie? Are they are they looked down upon as a side that have just bought their way to the success that they've enjoyed over the last decade or so? They don't necessarily have the tradition of a Leicester or a Worcester or a London Irish or a Harlequins even, for example.
They don't, but not every club has that tradition. That's just a fact of it. There's a great deal of skepticism surrounding them at the minute around the current salary cap investigations, and that's probably a lot of the source of that. That grudging, it's growing towards grudging respect, I think, and it has to be just because of what they're putting out on the pitch. But as I say, you look at that starting side, six of them academy players who played for the club since the age of 18, four more joined the club before 20. And if you look at the kind of intellectual property they brought up in their coaching pathway as well, under Mark McCall, Mark McCall has had under him during his time there, Paul Gustard, Andy Farrell, Rory Teague and Don Barrell, the guys who've moved on to the RFU as well. So on the field, there has to be that grudging respect, because what they are achieving is so impressive.
So let's look at the situation on the field, because it has all the ingredients to have been a real classic Heineken Champions Cup final. There was a few observations that stem from the win over Munster around the illegality or otherwise of some of the manners in which Saracens maybe played the offside line, played the breakdown, targeting certain Munster players in the air. You could all look at it that they're breaking the rules and they aren't being policed properly, or you could also look at them as being the master of the dark arts and they have the nous and the ability and the know-how to be able to play the game and push the laws as far as they possibly can without finding themselves in hot water. And that is the way that New Zealand have been playing for the last 50 years. Munster, when they were winning Heineken Cups in 06 and 08, they certainly knew how to play the referee, the laws of the game as well, and knew exactly how far to push things. So I don't think it's necessarily something that can be fired at Saracens in a negative way.
You'd be crazy to go into a game against a team with Tug Burn and with Peter Omani in the side and not be hugely aggressive and not overtly target those players. I think if you throw into the mix, if you slow down a modern breakdown and look at it in slow motion, there will be three or four offences on either side. I think Munster fans can probably be justifiably miffed at the fact that Jerome Garces didn't maybe impose himself on that area quite strongly early on. A couple of early penalties for clear outs would have changed the course of the atmosphere of the game, and it wouldn't have allowed Saracens to go on those multi-phase attacks that eventually led to both of their tries. But I think overall it was really interesting to listen to Ronan O'Gara just then. They said it started with the kicking game. Ben Spencer is England's form nine at the minute. You got David Strettle, who came into the side at late notice for Sean Maitland and was superb in recovering. I think he recovered three of those box kicks early on. And what that just says is the strength of this Saracens team as far as a tactical identity is fantastic. And actually, they broke out of structure to break down Munster. They went into the game. They'd scored, I think, 22 of their 30 tries within the first three phases of attack. So strike moves have been really important, but they came up against the Munster side, who were far more organised, far more steely. Chris Farrell was superb in defence for them. And they had to find another way, and they did. You know, and that's that problem solving kind of sets them apart. And that's what has been the kind of major factor of this consistent success that they've had both domestically in Europe and in European competition.
And that was obviously built on a game plan and a real detailed build-up to the game that was put in place by Mark McCall and his coaching staff. Whenever there is discussion around the Irish head coaching job, and obviously there was when Declan Kidney left, there was when Joe Schmidt just told us that he was going to be leaving before Andy Farrell was officially announced as his successor. Mark McCall, Conor O'Shea, they're two of the names that are always just thrown in and around the discussion. And there's never really been a call for Mark McCall to get the job. There's never been an inkling in the remotest sense from him's point of view that it's something that he would be interested in. Does he get the credit over there for what he has achieved as a head coach? I'm not quite sure he does over here.
It's hard to give him the credit he deserves, because he deserves so much of it. He was so measured and so articulate in the aftermath of the game yesterday. He was talking about how they had to be so patient and how they had to break down Munster because of the respect they showed to Munster. And I thought actually it was a really fluent Saracens' performance in attack after that first kind of quarter. They looked a bit like Leinster as far as, you know, guys stepping up at first receiver, guys stepping up at scrum half to really keep that pressure on. And Peter Armani spoke afterwards about how with Owen Farrell and Alex Goode there, it was really difficult to defend and really difficult to cover all bases. And Martin Paul has to take a lot of credit for that. He has to take a lot of credit for the recruitment, the canny recruitment. You know, it's not just big names they're bringing in. It's people like Michael Rhodes who have grown into these test level players, although he hasn't made an England debut yet. He certainly, you know, and he also spoke interestingly about how that period when Saracens made a European semi-final, they lost in the final and they lost another European semi-final, how actually when he looks back now, they weren't ready to go to that next stage. And that takes, you know, to get through those tough periods and really, it sounds like he's really questioned himself and his own methods and he's evolved. And that's the mark of somebody that's a seriously special coach, I'd say.
Finally, Charlie, let's look at this Leinster Saracens matchup, and all things being equal, let's assume that those players who played at the weekend will be available for the final. So I'm thinking of the likes of Sean Crona, for example, who limped off with an injury. You would hope that Leinster won't suffer any further injuries. Both sides have pretty important, certainly Leinster important Pro 14 ties before the final. Saracens are obviously very well placed as regards their place in the playoffs. They can afford to lose a couple of games and maybe put out a couple of second string sides and still finish in the top two in behind Exeter Chiefs. Maitland will be back, I assume, so that will be one addition. It's a bit harsh on David Strettle, but Maitland will probably be back in that starting 15. How do you see the two teams in terms of where they are in their standing and the game breakers that they have and some of the matchups that we're going to have to sift through in the build-up?
Just absolutely, absolutely fascinating. I think Leinster's performance against Toulouse was more dominant than probably the scoreboard suggested. They totally suffocated a team that had been electric in attack throughout. I just hope that it's one on the back of good kind of attacking sequences rather than just a total kind of whoever suffocates the most kind of more aggressively
possibly the game will take on that sort of a pattern, isn't it, that the two teams cancel each other out almost, and it's just going to be a war of attrition, the two packs beating each other to a pulp over the course of the 80 minutes, and it's down to the right boots of Owen Farrell and Johnny Sexton.
Yeah, that's a complete possibility. But you look at how dynamic those packs are. I think although they are extremely strong, there's a lot of dynamism there. There's a lot of athleticism there. You know, Maratoji against James Ryan. The next instalment of that is just fascinating. They both look right at the top of their games. I'm not sure Farrell and Johnny Sexton are quite at the top of their games, but that makes it more fascinating. Who problem solves the best? Who gets their side in the right areas of the field and that sort of stuff. It's excellent. The midfield's especially interesting. You know, whether Brad Barrett can get back to right at the top of the game, such a talisman for them. And Leinster, I thought Robbie Henshaw and Gary Ringrose were brilliant together as well. So yeah, I hope it's not a slugfest, but you know, they're just so polished, both sides, that it could descend into that sort of thing.
And finally, I know you had a close watch on Scott Fardy at the weekend, and it's an unusual situation that maybe Saracens fans won't necessarily be familiar with, whereby Leinster have this perennial issue of Jemison Gibson-Park, Scott Fardy and James Lowe, of which they can only have two in their Champions Cup matchday squad. The decision was made for Leinster at the weekend because Jemison Gibson-Park was unavailable, but if he's back, you do have that particular issue that Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster are going to have to deal with in the build-up. James Lowe, you think, has to be in the team. Scott Fardy, you think, has to be in the team. And he's very much the second-choice scrum half in behind Luke McGrath, Jemison Gibson-Park. They did have Hugh O'Sullivan on the bench at the weekend. For you, is Fardy the one of the three that absolutely has to be in Leinster's team?
I think I'll probably look at James Lowe and Scott Fardy together just because of how many bases they cover as far as an upside for a squad. And if you've got those two together, you've got the steel, you've got the streetwise nous of Fardy, and you've got moments like James Lowe can produce with that first try. I think Brian O'Driscoll pointed out on commentary, he got the ball about 10 metres away from the line and had two or three bodies to get through to score. Do Leinster have anyone else that can do that? Probably not. Do they have anybody that can give the level of that gnarled kind of menace around the breakdown that Fardy can? I'm not sure when, you know, Luke McGrath is in excellent form. So I was surprised it was going to be any other kind of decision than that. So I would expect that that's what Saracens will face.
Charlie, thanks a million. We'll chat to you hopefully again before the game.
Cheers. Thank you.
That's Charlie Morgan at the Telegraph giving us some early thoughts ahead of May 11th, and that showdown between Leinster and Saracens in the Heineken Champions Cup final at St James's Park in Newcastle. In the meantime, here on O2B AM, John Duggan has popped in to say good morning to us. Hello, sir.
Dave and Johnny, how are you doing this morning?
How are you, Jenny?
A dyed-in-the-wool Tottenham fan, as anyone who listens to the show will know. You saw Tottenham beat Brighton with that brilliant Christian Eriksen strike last night. The big news from your point of view on a personal level is that you have your tickets booked for both legs of the Champions
League. Well, I've got my flights booked and I've got my accommodation booked, but I don't have my tickets yet, so I'm hoping to use that file of fax that is somewhere in the dusted in my house to pick up some numbers and make a few phone calls and see what can happen. Have you been yet, Dave, given that you're in the top echelons of commentary now? Have you been to the new White Hart Lane yet?
I haven't, no. Okay. I was at White Hart Lane for the last game. And I can't remember who they played, but
the last game of the stadium,
yeah,
Manchester United.
There you go. And they won that game as well, didn't they?
2-1, yes.
And I recall looking on rather quizzically at the time of the Tottenham fans invading the field afterwards and ripping up large swathes
of wall style,
the White Hart Lane turf, while looking 100 yards to my left and seeing the new stadium hulking over the old one, thinking, you know, it's not like Main Road to the Etihad. It's not like some of the brand new stadiums that we've seen clubs like West Ham going from Upton Park to the London Stadium. They could literally spit from the current stadium into the new one. But look, I guess there was an awful lot of emotion and history and tradition wrapped up with the old White Hart Lane. Firstly, like on my script here that Tommy has typed into me, it says John is going to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium this weekend for the first time. Is that what we're calling it?
Well, that's what's been called officially, I think. And they're actually going to rename the train station, Tottenham Hotspur. Which is, I think, it's going to cost them around £15 million to change the name, okay, and upgrade the facilities. So,
is the new White Hart Lane not a more romantic?
I prefer the romance, but I think naming rights will generally come into these kind of conversations.
Yeah, it won't be the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium for too long.
It'll be the Dave McIntyre Stadium, or DaveMcIntyre.com, or something like that, or JohnnyWardsTips.com Stadium, or something like that. You know, so I can't wait to go. I'm going to West Ham on Saturday, so I'm looking forward to it. Everybody's been raving about it. Even when you go to those kind of websites, the Football Ground Guide, and you get neutrals talking about these kind of things, talking about the fact that it is quite close to the pitch. There's a huge kind of like Dortmund-style south stand of 17,000 seats, and the acoustics are apparently very good. There's a giant kind of gold cockerel at the top of the south stand. So where I think the halfway line used to be, so everything has kind of been symbolically geared towards this new stadium, which is completely cashless. You can't use cash inside it.
Yeah, there are nods to the old stadium everywhere, aren't there?
Yeah, lots of kind of memorabilia and that kind of thing. So, but ultimately, the reason I was watching last night is we're hoping that we're going to perform on the pitch. And Brian Kerr, just a brilliant man, and he's got these Kerrisms that he's filtered into commentary over the last years. And he had one recently on Today FM, which is Duncan Duffy are like a donut shop. You know, and Duncan Duffy, Duncan Shane Duffy, were just like, it was just the aerial bombardment. They were controlling the skies of London last night. But unfortunately for Brighton, they were penned inside their own half for most of the game. And Eriksen has got that magic touch. I was waiting. I was thinking to myself, I was getting very frustrated watching it. And I was going, who's the Bale here? We need Bale. And then Eriksen produced a Bale moment by fizzing it into the bottom corner. 2 minutes to go.
It's a huge goal because it takes the pressure off the game against West Ham to some degree, with more than one eye on what's coming down the tracks on Tuesday night when Ajax visit North London. So does Pochettino put out a second string this Saturday?
No, he can't afford to. We don't have the players. We haven't had anybody signed in two windows.
But changes. I would imagine he will utilise the resources of his squad as much as he possibly can this Saturday.
So Sanchez, for example, I'd expect Davinson Sanchez to play. Maybe
Boyd
will play. Ben Davies will play. Eric Dier might play. I don't know if Vincent Janssen will play. He came on for a cameo last night.
I assume Son will play, given that he can't play Tuesday.
Son will play, yeah, exactly. So he'll be strategic around his thinking. Arsenal go to Wolves tonight. United have Chelsea at the weekend. So it is falling Tottenham's way, but they do still have work to do. They're going to Bournemouth, who can be tricky, on their day away from home, and then Everton in the final game at home. So, look, it's not there yet, but it's closer to being there than it was. And it would have been very much a Tottenham thing to do, to blow it last night, have a nil-all draw. But the new Tottenham, I think, is a different beast. And I think that's why there's a belief there that they're going to get there and going to finish the job.
See, I'm not sure they are a different beast. We were talking about the new Tottenham, for example, before the Wolves game two months ago or 6 weeks ago at Wembley, and they vomited all over themselves that day. I don't quite buy that they have eliminated the propensity to do that from their DNA just yet. I'm going to need to see a few more examples over the next few weeks and heading into next season before I'm convinced that the new Tottenham, as you call them, are a well-oiled winning machine that can dig results out when absolutely necessary, because they were title contenders that day. They were being spoken about that in the same terms, and they lost 3-1 having...
If they beat Ajax, will they be the new Tottenham?
Well, no. I'm talking about Premier League titles. But Tottenham in Europe, they have shown that they can do both. They've gone to places like Dortmund. They've beaten Madrid at home. They've gone to Juve and turned out great results. But then at the same time, when the tie is there for the taking, they've somehow managed to lose to Juve in a second leg at Wembley Stadium. So,
yeah, I think that was naivety.
Let's not forget they lost last week.
Yeah, I think that was naivety last year.
In the end.
Yeah, Eriksen, bizarrely, the match winner last night was, you know, he's going to be sold, to be honest, if that goal had stood. I understand what you're saying. I think, though, that is becoming less and less of an issue over the years, although they still haven't won a trophy. Pochettino has never won a trophy in his managerial career, and like how they probably wish they had him at Manchester United right now or going into next season.
there's an understatement. Absolutely. Tell me, two legs with Ajax. I was fortunate enough to commentate on both first and second leg of the Juve games.
What's the insight then?
They're so good.
And is it the fearlessness of youth?
It really is. Now, that's probably a little too simplistic a view to take on it, because there are very experienced players in that Ajax team, like Daley Blind, like Dusan Tadic, for example, like Lasse Schüne, who's 32 and has played for Denmark for over 10 years. And so it isn't just a bunch of 19, 20, 21-year-olds in the team. But I was high as a kite leaving the commentary box after the second leg for the manner in which they performed against Juventus. Obviously, I watched the highlights of their win at the Bernabeu in the last round. And everyone wants to talk about De Ligt and De Jong, who one of which has gone to Barcelona.
Van de Beek as well.
Donny van de Beek is the third guy. He's 21, doesn't get any of the same headlines and paper column inches that the other two get. But they are playing like a team that know they're in bonus territory. They've absolutely nothing to lose. They're trying to continue with a title race of their own against PSV Eindhoven in the Eredivisie at the same time. The one thing I'm pretty sure of is that they're going to score a couple of goals in this tie, and the Tottenham are probably going to have to get 3 or 4 to go through. Will they do that? Minus Son in the first leg and Harry Kane?
The way I kind of feel about this game, I think this will be tighter. I think actually this will be tighter, and I think that Tottenham, I think the first leg could be quite dull. I think they need to almost play the Jose way, the way, you know, maybe Ajax have come on a long way in 2 years since that Europa League final. But I think Tottenham need to be
physical.
Yeah, and can't be too open in the first game. And Tottenham are good away from home and trying to score away from home in the second leg. I think if Ajax are scoring, like if it's a 2-2 draw, for example, at the new White Hart Lane next Tuesday, it's over for me if I score. You know, so I prefer a 1-0. I prefer the kind of industry that Tottenham showed against Manchester City in the first leg, which was going to be a goalless draw until someone got that like a late goal.
Yeah, I'm thinking the tie with Dortmund, whereby Jadon Sancho, for example, he looked great in the first half at Wembley, but Tottenham's athleticism, physical prowess, saw them take complete control. Sissoko bossing people around.
Now he won't be fit either. Once again, it'll be Wanyama instead. So,
but United bullied Ajax in that final.
Yeah,
so something similar needs to happen.
That's what I'm thinking, and also maybe Ajax's naivete on the stage. Surely that's going to. How can you be? You can be very fearless. I know in 95 they had a very fearless team. Kluivert scored a winning goal. He's 19 years of age, and you'd Seedorf and these kind of players in the team. That was a beautiful Ajax team, but they'd already won a UEFA Cup 3 years previously, a lot of those players. So I do think, whether it's the semi-final or the final, Ajax is not going to win the Champions League. It's not going to happen. And I think the winner of the Champions League is probably the other side of the draw. But I just do think Tottenham are good on the ball. They do control the ball well. They generally have a lot of possession in their games. And I can see quite a tight game, a physical game next Tuesday, and then Tottenham then go for it in the second leg. That's the way. That's the only way I think they can go through. Because it's as open as you say. Tottenham were a little bit open last night, even in the Brighton game. Can't see it happening. But the gut is the gut. Johnny, you know yourself with gut and predictions, that kind of thing. Mm. The gut's telling me we're going to be in that final.
City scored 4 on the second leg, missed a penalty in the first leg. I think there are goals in this Ajax team over these two legs. I'm lucky enough, I'm doing the first leg on Tuesday night. I can't wait. They've been one of the stories, both teams really, that the fact they're in the semis have been two of the stories of the season. Before we go, lads, busy few weeks ahead in Irish racing, given that the two of you, John Duggan and Johnny Ward, are sitting alongside me at the 2019 Punchestown Festival. It gets underway. It's Tuesday, April 30th. It runs all the way through to the 4th of May. What can we expect from it? I mean, it usually brings fireworks. It almost always brings the weather. It definitely brings the racegoers.
Willie Mullins to dominate.
Yeah, he's just coming in great form. Three of the first five in the National. Hopefully see the likes of Sam Crow back. Hopefully see some horses that maybe didn't run at Cheltenham appear. You know, Willie has a lot of horses that haven't really run yet or haven't run much this season. And great, we're going to have great crowds. And if the weather holds up, it's going to be a fantastic Punchestown. And, you know, Barry Geraghty, Ruby Walsh, Davy Russell, all 40 this year. It could be one of them having his last Punchestown. I'm just not sure who.
John?
Well, I think if it's Camboy against Album Photo, if they do meet in the Gold Cup, that would be great. What I love about Punchestown, for anybody who wants to go, it's like, I love the fact that they've got the races about 20 to 4 is the first race, generally in like nice sunny weather.
Matinee meeting, yeah.
Yeah, you can do a little bit of work in the morning, you can knock off then for the day, and then there's usually a Champions League game on in the evenings. As you say, the 30th, that's the day of the Spurs' first leg. You get into Nice and you watch a bit of football. So I always kind of, it's a kind of a day where you can kind of end up in weird places and you can kind of just get off the beaten track with people and having the crack and, you know, gallivanting and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it can produce strange results at times. I find Punchestown can produce very odd results because of the way that Johnny's saying that some horses have been geared towards other festivals and maybe are over the top and then other horses are coming through. So it can be odd results. But generally, the main races are won by the best horses. But it is very well organised. It's great crack. It's great fun. It's accessible. And this is not an ad, but it's a good show. It's a good show, and also, you know, every single day has got something about it from the Tuesday through to the Saturday. So bring it on.
A ringing endorsement of all that Punchestown has to offer. Tuesday, April 30 to Saturday, 4th of May. And here on Off the Ball, we're giving away a daily prize of two tickets with entry to the reserved enclosure at the Punchestown Racecourse, including lunch that day. We'll also throw in a shuttle bus as well and an overnight stay with an evening meal for two at the Louis Fitzgerald Hotel. So to be in with the chance of winning, you'll have to tune into Off the Ball tonight. We'll be giving you more detail on that. A little bit of housekeeping as well before you leave you this morning. We're going to be announcing our Liverpool jersey winner later today on Off the Ball, so stay tuned to our Twitter account for that. Johnny, thanks a million for coming in.
Not at all, great to be here.
Help me through my return.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift, the morning shift, but you always feel kind of invigorated after it.
Are you going to be watching tonight's game from behind the couch? Well, you won't be behind the couch, you'll be at the Off the Ball racing event.
Alexander Hotel, hopefully there's some sort of a big screen facility nearby.
Don't have much faith in Man U to do Liverpool the hugest of favours tonight.
Ruby Walsh was on the panel. Ruby's a big sports fan. And Robbie Power, I think Jer as well. There'll be a lot of interest in the game. I won't have much interest in the sense of I think it's a bit of a formality, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, Off the Ball is back at 7 o'clock tonight. The football show, that'll be based, obviously, around the Manchester Derby. Wednesday night rugby with Keith Wood and Andy Dunn and an awful lot more besides. OTB AM is back tomorrow morning with the fallout from events at Old Trafford. We'll know an awful lot more by this time tomorrow as to where the Premier League trophy is going to end up than we do right now. And the shot clock with Kieran Donaghy in studio as well. Thanks a million for watching and or listening to us this morning, and we'll chat to you later.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.